bill today is House Bill 2139. And we'll open a public hearing on that. And Ms. Ward, could you give us a quick rundown on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2139 would exempt the unclaimed or abandoned property of Department of Corrections inmates from the Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act. It would authorize the Department of Corrections to determine and direct disposition of their property under another set of rules that would be set up by the DOC administratively. The history behind this is that in 1997, some of the laws were changed, and the Department of State Lands was no longer required to hold on to the property of inmates, or the DOC had to hold on to the property as opposed to the Department of State Lands, and it has, from what I understand from the proponents of this bill, become administratively a little bit difficult for them. So that is what 2139 does. We did receive some Dash 1 amendments. We did receive them. LC was able to get those done. It would narrow the scope of the original bill, and it would narrow Section 2 to the Department of Correction, Department of Corrections disposing of tangible property only. And while tangible property is not defined in Oregon Revised Statutes, intangible property is, and so the position essentially would be that tangible property is anything not intangible. Tangible property would include things like shoes, musical instruments, but would not include things like trust account funds or benefit checks.
Okay. Stan? Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Stan Zerniak. I'm Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I appreciate having the opportunity to address you regarding House Bill 2143. Committee counsel has done a very good job, I think, of articulating the main issues involved in this bill. I'd like to point out that we release about 4,000 inmates annually, and collectively they leave behind a significant amount of property. Most of the property really is kind of minor property in the form of old socks, underwear, shoes, and the like. The current circumstance that we're trying to remedy is that under the circumstances right now, what we have to do with this property is we have to inventory it, we have to then store it, and then we have to keep it for 2 years before we turn it over to the Department of State Lands for disposition. This bill would give us the authorization to write rules to be able to dispose of this property as we see appropriate. And again, I'd like to really emphasize a vast majority of the property has no value. We've met with the Department of State Lands. They are not interested in receiving this property even after 2 years, so it would solve several issues for us.
What will they do with that? I mean, does they give the goodwill or just send to the dumper?
Chair Barker, I think we have a couple of options. One would be, you're right, we could donate it to a number of different charities out there, or in some cases, if it's not even worth donating, we could dispose of it.
Thank you. Any questions?
I do. Yeah. Mr. Chair, thanks. Stan, I'm just kind of curious, two questions. Do you know what the percentage is of property that's successfully returned within a two-year period?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, I assume you mean return to the inmate's family?
Yes.
The answer to that would be it really varies. Some inmates elect, because of the type of property that we're talking about, not to take it with them or not to pay the postage to send it home prior to release. Items such as, in some institutions, we do allow inmates to purchase TVs. Most of those would be sent back to the family, although even in some cases those are left behind because they're old and they're not working very well, and we have to dispose of that type of property also. But in terms of actual percentages, I don't know. I can tell you this, it's a fairly high percentage of those kind of, you know, the underwear and the socks and that kind of stuff.
Okay, and one more question, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, too, then, have you ever kind of kept track of the hours involved, for manpower hours involved in doing this?
Chair Barker and Representative Wilson. That is a good question. I don't think we've actually sat down and done that, but having been the superintendent at the Oregon State Penitentiary for a couple of years myself, I can tell you that that property room was continually full of inmate discarded property, and there was an officer who spent a very good part of his or her day inventorying that stuff, storing it, and then, you know, disposing of it within that two-year period. And that is repeated at every institution throughout the system.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Zerniak, I just want to make sure I understand what's happening in the Dash 1 amendments. It looks like the bill was originally drafted more broadly to pick up intangible property, and particularly including the phone card account balances, and that now under these amendments, deleting Section 3 of the bill, then it's being limited to just tangible things, as you say, clothing, personal effects, so anything that's even fairly minor amounts that are like a balance on a phone card or something of that sort that is not, you can't put your hands on, then is outside of this rule, and you would then have to account for it. And maybe you could explain what happens then if the amendments are adopted to that kind of property.
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, that is a good question. Our intent with that is that when an inmate has a balance on his or her phone card and they leave the custody of the Department of Corrections on an authorized basis, this does not include an inmate who escapes, for example, or walks away from a work crew. In those cases, we would like to be able to take that money and give it back to the inmate to help them in the transition once they get back out in the community. We would be concerned about not wanting to take that money and penalize them just because they had a balance on their phone card, for example. In the case of escape, that money wouldn't then be placed back in the inmate welfare fund.
Follow-up, but this bill, as with the proposed amendment, then doesn't address that at all. You have sufficient authority to do what you're trying to, you already do and want to do with respect to the intangible property. Am I understanding that right?
Representative Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, that's correct.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll move. Any other questions? We'll move to work session.
Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2139.
Any objections? Okay, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2139, as amended, be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion passes, and Representative McPherson will be here. We have next two bills are work sessions that are scheduled. Open a work session on House Bill 2140.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we first had a public hearing on House Bill 2140 on January 20th. It was very early in the session. And it required persons confined in correctional facilities to exhaust administrative remedies before filing complaints with the health professional regulatory boards. This was to, you may recall, to prevent inmates from going to the medical or dental regulatory boards, who are required when a complaint is filed to begin an investigation. And we heard from opponents of this bill that it could restrict the rights of the inmates. The proponents pointed out, however, that even if the inmate had the right to go before the medical board or the dental board, for example, that would not meet an inmate's medical or dental needs. It would simply result in a filing against the medical health professional. We did receive some Dash 1 amendments, and the Dash 1 amendments, if exhausted, would give the regulatory board discretion to investigate an inmate's complaint based on whether or not the inmate had exhausted all administrative remedies. That way, if the regulatory board felt that what the inmate was complaining about had sufficient merit, they could begin an investigation and not have to worry about the exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Any questions on that? Ms. Meyer wanted to speak. If you do so briefly, we'd appreciate it.
I have written this one, and I would like to summarize, but I'd like to get this. Chair Barker, members of committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I appreciate you allowing me to testify briefly on this matter. I'm handing you testimony that's really identical. One has some attachments, so one is a little thicker than the other. We continue to be quite concerned about both of these proposals. They're intended to replicate the exhaustion requirements set forth in the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act, and the main purpose of that act was to apply to federal courts, not state courts. It was not intended to shut down access to state courts. One of the major concerns we have is that under the grievance procedure set forth by DOC, an inmate can never really fully exhaust the administrative grievance process. DOC is not required to respond to a grievance within a specified time, and it must only make a reasonable attempt, and there is no end sight. We're very concerned that DOC can use the grievance procedures to basically usurp the legislative role in a statute of limitations matter. And let me just briefly explain. When you have usually 1 or 2 years, or somewhat longer, as you all have dealt with in other legislation, to file a claim in court, you have a statute of limitations time period in which to do that. It can be 1 year, it can be 2 years, it can be more than that. If an inmate is required to file a grievance, say 14 days, 7 days, 48 hours after an incident, otherwise they have waived any ability to file a grievance, then if they cannot exhaust their administrative grievance process, because they can't even participate in it if that time has come and gone for health reasons, for inability to comprehend, for any other reason. And as such, the opportunity to proceed with legitimate meritorious claims could be cut down drastically under administrative rules. We've seen this in other jurisdictions across the country. So I raise that concern that you're turning over that authority to DOC to do that. I raise a concern of constitutional level, both Article 1, Section 10, Article 1, Section 20. With Article 1, Section 10, it's the right to have a remedy in court, particularly the Small Claims Bill, 21-43, implicates an ability for an inmate to bring a claim to Small Claims Court different from anyone else. That's a remedy in court we think is implicated. And Article 1, Section 20 requires, basically it's our equal protection provision and not treating one class different than the other. My testimony touches on briefly counties, but I won't go into that. It sounds like counties are not going to be a part of this, and we're pleased because that is even more alarming to us. The Regulatory Health Board 2140, I know you've opened up, Chair, probably a hearing only on that bill right now. Is that correct?
No, we're in work session.
Work session for both or just one. I just want to make sure that my testimony gets on, so I don't come back up here.
We're just for one, but you can take testimony on both.
Okay. Thank you.
I see. Now, yeah.
Right. Because I'm going to speak on both, and I know you don't want me to get back up here twice. First of all, in terms of the regulatory board, an inmate has to exhaust an administrative process that seems to never be a system that could provide them any kind of relief. The prison grievance system doesn't have the expertise to determine whether a healthcare provider is competent. And yet we're having an inmate proceed through that process, taking the time of the corrections department when they can never really necessarily rectify that. That is the medical board or other licensing board's purview. So DOC cannot provide any remedy. Why are we having inmates go through an administrative process that they may not be able to exhaust? I'm also concerned, and I hope maybe this committee can look into, I've attached to my testimony a chart from the Prison Health Services, Inc. This is a private, for-profit health care provider that serves inmates in prison across the country, and it's my understanding in Oregon. The New York Times in the last month ran a three-part series, and you'll see on page 3 of my testimony, and I'm not going to go into it at the top. It is one horror story after another horror story about the inadequate medical care provided to people. And I raise concern that if we are using them in Oregon, I know they've got an advertisement right now for Hillsborough County Jail, but I also understand from Department of Corrections they use them in some manner, that that raises additional alarm that medical providers through that system have proven quite incompetent, and it's cost millions and thousands of dollars to states and many lives. 2143, the small claims court matter. First of all, again, you're requiring an inmate to exhaust remedies. Can Department of Corrections, it's kind of a question I have, I'm just not sure, can they make an inmate whole under the grievance system? If something is destroyed or lost, does DOC have the ability to provide the financial remuneration or any other aspect to make the person whole? If not, and they may be able to, in which case that addresses our one level of our question, but if not, again, what's the point of the grievance process if they can't? You know, I raised concerns last time, and I just want to briefly touch on again the issue of when a recovery for loss of property or damage of property is higher than the value. You know, sometimes there's a reason behind that. DOC hasn't provided much evidence of that going on in small claims court. And if it is, there may be a very good circumstance. You will hear when Senate Bill 89 comes over from the Senate side, DOC's proposal to set forth in law a custodial sexual misconduct. Apparently, there are increasing numbers of crimes occurring in the prisons where corrections officers are raping and sexually assaulting inmates. There is a power dynamic that I know you're all familiar with that goes on in the prisons. And as such, they needed to have this protection put into law through Senate Bill 89. And I would suggest that occasionally, to a lesser degree, that abuse of power over an inmate might occur in terms of treating their property and other items in a manner that is to intimidate and otherwise provide coercive activities. And so if there's a need for an inmate to be able to prove the case that it's beyond just the cost of the sunglasses or something else is going on, it's important for the courts to have the power to handle it at that time. Now, I do believe Oregon is different from other jurisdictions across the country, but the way that we ensure that we are better than most is to keep the necessary checks and balances between the various branches of government, which the current law provides. Thank you.
What is the statute of limitations for filing a complaint with the Health Regulatory Board?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I apologize. I don't know what the timeline is. I don't know if Representative McPherson knows in terms of legal, in terms of malpractice claims against lawyers.
Well, I guess I see those as two different things. I mean, a claim brought for professional negligence is really a separate matter from a complaint to a regulatory board. They may arise out of the same events. But I think, you know, there was going to be a statute of limitations, which generally for tort claims is, what, 2 years in Oregon?
I believe so.
I think that's right. But it's not my area of practice. But a complaint to a regulatory board that somebody's license should be pulled or put under some kind of scrutiny is really a separate proceeding. It's not a claim for damages. And I wasn't aware there was any statute of limitations for that.
Chair Barber, members of the committee, I'm certainly happy to look into that. I believe I can't say I haven't had an opportunity to look into what the timelines are for someone to bring a claim to the medical board or the dental board. One would think there needs to be some timeliness on it for them to do any investigation.
What relief would an inmate get from a regulatory board?
The relief that that inmate gets and any other is if you have an incompetent doctor practicing or other health care provider in the system, that they cannot get that kind of relief through going to court seeking damages or action in terms of any medical health care that they need to provide. It could be a very systematic, low-level, not necessarily life-threatening at the moment but it could be an ongoing mistreatment for providing the types of care that inmates need. And so it's actually not necessarily just for that particular inmate, but to point out a series or pattern that may be going on that they have complained about to the Department of Corrections. We don't want doctors abusing inmates. And I would think that if there's even that opportunity or remote chance that that's going on, then that needs to be addressed by the medical board and ideally by Department of Corrections, but in case not, by the medical licensing board saying that you have gone beyond the scope of your ability to practice and are engaging in malpractice.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Give me a moment. Mr. Chair, it seems to me the concern that if there's a limitation on the time within which a complaint can be lodged with the licensing board, and that time would be running during the period in which the administrative procedures, claims procedures within the department were being pursued, that's a legitimate concern. I'm skeptical that there's any statute of limitations on bringing forward a complaint to the licensing board. It seems like it's inconsistent.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson. Well, let's not just look at the statute of limitations. Let's look at the ability to, one, the underlying problem. Let's get in there quickly if there is any incompetency or mistreatment of inmates. Let's not wait 2 years that you've exhausted or a year. They need to be treated quickly if they're frivolous on their face. And I failed to mention in my testimony, but I think the solution on the healthcare regulatory boards is they need to be moving quickly. That's the policy. If the concern is they file a claim and there's investigation and it's taking forever for the regulatory board to move, that's not the fault of the inmate. That's the fault of the regulatory board. And that can happen if you're an inmate or anyone else in the outside world. A doctor or medical provider will be under that cloud for as long as that regulatory board takes to resolve the matter. And the policy change should be they need to be moving quickly. They have the authority, I assume, if it's on the face frivolous, to say, no, yeah, we've looked at this and there's no basis.
Go ahead.
If I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have the relevant statutes 676.160 through 180, which are processing of complaints against healthcare professionals. I would make just a couple of notes from reviewing these statutes as Ms. Meyer has been testifying. First, I would point out that it does not appear to set any deadline under which an inmate would have to file a complaint. Second, the board would have between 4 to 5 months, the investigator assigned to investigate the complaint would have 4 to 5 months after the board receives the complaint to return that complaint to the board, and then the board would decide what action, if any, to take. It does not, in my I'll just read 676.165 states, upon receipt of a complaint by any person against a licensee or applicant, a health professional regulatory board shall assign one or more persons to act as investigator of the complaint. It does not appear to me that the regulatory board would have the ability to review a complaint, decide it to be frivolous, and not investigate it. It appears to me that there would have to be an investigation made.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, and that will be the case regardless. And so what this does is delay, because it either says to the regulatory board, well, we're going to look at it and somehow decide, and I don't know how an inmate proves that they've exhausted administrative remedies, so that's a first hurdle. But now the regulatory board is going to have to say, you haven't exhausted, go back. And then the cloud will remain under the inmate as they proceed through the grievance process. For those inmates who are intent on engaging in frivolous activity, this will simply prolong the pain. Assuming they can get back before the regulatory board, you've just extended the cloud over the corrections officer and the medical provider for far longer than if the board simply moved and acted quickly.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I'm looking back at some material that was handed to us when we first took testimony on this bill back in January, and I haven't gone back to refresh myself on it, but I'm looking at OAR 291-109-0140, which describes the grievance review system within DOC, and I haven't refreshed myself or even really entirely understood it when I was going through it before. I do see specific timelines in here that within which appeals need to be responded to, and DOC's rules. And so I wanted to have Ms. Meyer focus on that, because the concern that's been raised that I think we need to be probably most mindful of is whether or not there's any clear end point to the internal grievance procedure. That is, what this bill does is it requires that an inmate with a concern about the quality of care has to first go through the grievance procedure, and then once right. that's exhausted, then go on to the licensing board. And so that if there's a risk of there being kind of a loop here that they get caught into and can never get out to the licensing board, that's, I think, a legitimate concern. So the question is, can they exhaust those remedies effectively? And as I say, I haven't studied this rule here, but I do see some specific timelines. For example, on page 4, appeal timelines, an appeal must be received by the grievance coordinator within 14 days of the coordinator's return to the date to the inmate. The assistant director shall respond to the inmate's grievance appeal within 30 days of receipt of the appeal. I see in D, the assistant director's decision on inmate's grievance appeal is final and not subject to further review. That would be no further review internally within the department. So I do see what looked like specific timelines within which a person could complete the grievance process. And so I just wanted to... we're probably educating ourselves together here, but I wanted Ms. Meyer to have an opportunity to respond to the observations I had about what I'm seeing here.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, one, the testimony from DOC on this side of the building, the other side, I think it was in front of this committee, and they certainly can correct me if I'm wrong, was that they make every attempt, but they are not able to stick to these deadlines. Number two, the first level of grievance says that at the top of page 4, every effort shall be made to return the response to the grievance coordinator for processing within 15 working days. And that's the first level of appeal, of making the complaint. There is no hard and fast timeline. It can go on and on. And the testimony from DOC is that while they make every effort, it doesn't.
So should we 15 days, if it's not settled, just throw them out or what? I mean, you have to be reasonable about this. There's some things that can't get done. So,
Chair Barker.
Yes, go ahead.
Let me pursue an angle on that. Ms. Meyer, would it meet your concern if we were to make it clear that if the department doesn't follow the timelines in its own rules, that then the requirement of exhaustion of the grievance procedure has been met, so that the department would have the opportunity to then respond within those timelines, but if they don't, then off to the BME or right. the nurses board or whatever.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, it does go a long way to addressing what we concern with the potential endless loop, that it does give an inmate clear guidance and resolution, and then they can proceed to other opportunities they have that can then resolve them once and for all. So it would go a way to address one of our primary concerns on this proposal.
Okay, thank you. Anything else?
Okay. No, I think that's it.
Thank you. Mr. Stan, did you want to answer anything of that? Or
I would like for him to respond on the timeline.
Do you have a question now?
Not a question, but maybe a statement. I recall when we made the tour at the prison, and Mr. Williams was talking quite in depth on a couple of times about the lack of medical care that these people had had, that they were providing for themselves for 10, 15, 20 years before they got there. Therefore, they were being received at a far less standard than what maybe the average person might be out here. Well, this goes along with, most often, their lifestyle choices that got them into trouble and what their priorities in life were. Now, I want to make sure they're treated properly and there's, you know, an access to medical care and a reasonable system. But it's going to be very difficult for the taxpayer to provide a Cadillac system at a standard that would be far beyond what they would be able to provide for themselves or took the initiative to do for themselves in the first place.
Chair Barker, President Krieger, I agree that there are many inmates coming into the system who've not had healthcare services, and our concerns aren't with being able to try to get the Cadillac, particularly through the licensing boards. That's not an avenue that they could even have the authority to insist on that. So if that's where an inmate is seeking that type of recourse, they'd be out pretty quickly. It's where there's incompetency and malpractice going on, which is different than getting the Cadillac. So I'm trying to distinguish between the two because I'm not pushing here for the type of health care that I think many of you would like to see. Also, Mr. Sugarman reminded me, and I don't know if Department of Corrections, he reminded me, and I don't have an independent memory of this, but they indicated that they might be actually reviewing these grievance procedures and changing them.
We're going to ask them.
And so if they are being changed, we want to make sure what safeguards are being put in as we make this type of proposal. Thank you.
Yeah. Mary?
You made me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and we represent the folks who work inside the institutions. I want to be very clear about this process. There's two sides of this piece of paper that we've been talking about today. There's no one in medical services that I know of that wants to delay appropriate and adequate treatment for inmates. On the other side of this paper are inmates who went to medical licensing boards in an effort to force the department and our medical personnel into doing procedures that were not budgeted for, nor funded, nor necessary. Because they do want at least a Cadillac and preferably something a little higher while they're in prison. And I think that Representative Krieger brought up a good point. These folks do, I mean, generally speaking, and I don't want to like paint the brush that every inmate ignores their health, but by and large, a lot of our inmates come to us in very serious health decline. And seeking out a dentist is not necessarily the first thing they think of when they get up in the morning when they're not inside the institutions. And so, you know, coming to the institution and then asking us to do things that the budget committee has not given us the authority to do has been problematic. And yes, the Health Licensing Board demanded at one point that we do things that they would not require a community dentist to do. And if the committee wants that information, I can probably go back in my files from 2 years ago and find it. But it was a pretty horrific experience for some of our dentists who had their licenses in jeopardy for, as I recall, it was 18 months. So when we're talking about time frames, you know, all we're asking here is that the inmate exhaust their internal procedures before they go to a licensing board and call into question the license of a medical professional who's working inside those institutions. That's all we're asking for. And we're not trying to excuse anybody who's not doing their job. There's a process for that, separate from this, and we'll live with that process. But this bill doesn't do any of those things. And everybody knows that the way you keep an institution running smoothly and peacefully is you keep the inmates satisfied that they're getting what they have coming to them legally and constitutionally.
Thank you. Any questions? Stan.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, again, thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. First of all, I'd like to say I absolutely agree with what Ms. Botkin just said. We do have dedicated professionals in the Department of Corrections. We are well aware and embrace our responsibility to provide a community standard level of care. We also are aware of the constitutional issues, and clearly we're aware that should we fail to meet that standard, we subject ourselves to habeas claims and other sanctions. In regards to this particular bill, it really is the decision of the licensing board whether or not an inmate should have to exhaust first the administrative remedies that we have available through our grievance procedure, or whether they want to, in fact, bypass that process and hear the inmate's complaint. And that I think, is a key part of this bill that's different from, or at least the amendment to this bill that's different from the original bill that was submitted. The other thing I'd like to just say is that our grievance procedure is not really terribly unlike most that you'll find throughout the country. Inmates do use that procedure. They use it frequently. If it had no value, they wouldn't use it. We are continually looking at ways that we can streamline that process, but I don't think you'll find our timelines are really that far out of line. Yes, we can do better. In some cases, we can probably do considerably better. But overall, I think we've got a system that does have some integrity. It does, in fact, resolve grievances that inmates have. And again, we are looking at ways of streamlining that process.
Thanks, Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I think all of us who have toured the institutions recognize that we have a dedicated group of people who are providing health service to the inmate population, and it was also apparent that that's a challenging population to serve, to say the least, and because of the lifestyle issues that Chair Krieger was alluding to, and a lot of the greater difficulty in providing health service to this population. I see this bill as a fairly narrow change. That is, it doesn't bar people from accessing the BME or other licensing boards. It simply requires they go through the grievance procedure, and that they have an unlimited amount of time to do that under the, I think we're learning about the rules of the licensing boards, because they're not cut off by a statute of limitations claim. I think it is a fair concern if people could get caught up in an administrative cycle that they couldn't break out of and therefore couldn't access the licensing board remedy or get through the licensing board without the board deciding to take it, which under the amendment they could. The licensing board could decide to do that. So I guess the key question is whether there's any risk of people not being able to exhaust their remedy within the grievance procedure. And Mr. Zerniak, do you have any concern about the concept I stated earlier that if the timelines in the grievance procedure weren't being met, then that constitutes exhaustion? That is, doing everything the inmate has to do on their side is sufficient, and if the institution doesn't respond within its timelines, then they have done everything they have to do as an inmate and could go directly to the licensing board. Do you have any concern about that?
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, I wouldn't have a huge issue with that. The only conceivable problem I would see is that in some cases, in the course of investigating a grievance, some of the key individuals that need to be consulted with may not be available, such as somebody who's on sick leave or somebody who's on vacation, and in fact, the timeline may go beyond the prescribed time frames. That doesn't happen a lot. It doesn't, but it does in fact occur. I still have to go back to, even while the grievance procedure is going on, we still have an obligation to provide a standard level of care. That doesn't stop just because the inmate's filing a grievance, and in fact we'll be providing the level of care that we're obligated to provide. So I don't see that as a huge issue, and I think it's one we could live with.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what the longest grievance has taken that you know of?
Chair Barker and committee. I think we're looking at the outside of about 4 months that a grievance could take.
Thank you. Okay. Questions?
Well, maybe not this question. I was just kind of going through the timelines, and it does add up to 4.5 months of maximum times were taken to file and respond. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you.
We're in work session on 2140.
Mr. Chair, I will move the -1 amendments into House Bill 2140.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair, by way of potentially legislative history, I read the bill, even pre-amendment, certainly with the amendments, as requiring exhaustion of internal prison grievance procedures, which are set by rule, I would point out, so that any failure of the department to respond within those timelines, I think, constitutes an exhaustion by the inmate, so that it is not necessary, I believe, to amend the text of House Bill 2140 to reflect that concept. I think it is implicit within the bill that as long as the inmate has done everything the inmate has to on their side, that a failure of the department to respond within the prescribed timelines under their rule would be relieve the inmate of any obligation to remain in that system and then to go forward through the directly to the licensing board. And on that basis, I then move House Bill 2140 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And I'll carry that one. And open a work order. Work session on House Bill 2143. We've heard the testimony about this.
Mr. Chair, just so the committee is aware, this is another bill that came to us. We had our first public hearing on January 20th. There were concerns. The original bill allowed an inmate or limited an inmate's rights to bring an action against a public body after exhausting all administrative remedies. And, of course, some of the concerns were that an inmate may have an action against the Internal Revenue Service and what administrative remedies would the DOC have. Additionally, the Department of Corrections did only want this to apply to small claims. So the -1 amendments deleted Section 2 in its entirety and replaces it by changing the scope of the original bill from any action against any public body to small claims actions against the Department of Corrections only. And again, it would require the exhaustion of administrative remedies prior to the filing of a small claim, and it would limit the claim to the value of the loss or destruction of the inmate's property.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendments be adopted to our House Bill 2143, -1 amendments.
Thank you. any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2143 as amended to the full committee with the due pass.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
And Representative Thatcher can carry that one. Before I do, I just want to say when we're set for a work session, we want to get going on that and not necessarily take a lot of testimony on that day. We want to have people heard. We don't want to deprive anybody of their right, but the time to do that is during the hearing, the public hearing. And with no further business, meeting is adjourned.